Wednesday, January the 20th, dawned beautiful and bright and early. The day had come. I began dressing before 8, and at 9:15 was ready to leave with Lyndon and Lucy for the interfaith prayer service at the National City Christian Church. Here would gather an invited group to listen to brief prayers for the day and the man and the country by members of many faiths. Dr. George Davis, the host minister of Lyndon's own church, Bill Baxter, my Episcopal minister, the Jewish Rabbi Gerstenfeld, I believe his name was, who gave the wonderful sermon on that grim Thanksgiving Day of 1963 when we went to an interfaith service, and, oh ecumenical joy, the Roman Catholic Monsignor, who had accompanied our own Archbishop Lucy from San Antonio. I noticed that he did not wear his full vestments, at least he just had on a clerical collar and a black suit, and he did not enter into the pulpit, but just stood down where the congregation sits. But he was there, and he gave a prayer. It was the Lord's Prayer, and he dismissed us with it. At least, this is a foot in the door. He had invited the court and the cabinet and the principal figures of government and the principal figures of Johnson City. The Morsons and Winters and Stubbs and Mabel Stribling and Minnie Cox, the Jimmy Leonards, and everybody like that whom we could think of to whom it would really mean something. All our house guests, of course. Martha Beavis from Houston, Sherman Birdwoods of Austin, the Browns, George R. of Business, and Hank S. of Labor, M.D. Bryant, the Clarks, Edward, and William H. Jr., the Bill Deasons, of course, and the Deaths. In fact, I'd spent hours trying to think to whom, sentimentally, this would mean something, and there was not an empty seat. And then, out the door, with many pictures being made, and back to the White House, and here occurred one of the most hilarious moments of the day. I asked to see the seating chart of the platform, and Leonard Marks, who had accompanied us, showed it to me. Bess and I had spent hours putting our portion of it together, and I was satisfied that everything was in good shape, until I looked at row B and saw Mrs. Fern Baines, B-A-I-N-E-S. I got a slight case of the shakes. I told Leonard, now we've got Aunt Avalee Baines and Aunt Josepha Baines Saunders, but we just don't have a Mrs. Fern Baines. And I just had visions of an empty seat there on the second row. How would I account for it? Leonard said he had insisted on getting the list typewritten and not in anybody's handwriting, that he had it proofread by Bess and by himself, that he just knew it was correct. I said, well, we'll just say, poor Cousin Fern, she took down with the pneumonia, and she couldn't make it. And you know what? Cousin Fern died. Wonder of wonders, Lucy appeared on time, looking lovely, in her navy blue and white outfit with a perky white hat, and Linda, very regal and handsome, in her light blue suit with Robin's fur hat. And I was very satisfied with my own American Beauty ensemble, with a bit of sealskin that tied under the chin and the off-the-face hat, especially the luxury of the silk-lined black gloves and the small and elegant alligator bag which Mary Ellen had given me. We rode down the avenue, Lyndon and I in one car, the one with the bulletproof glass top and sides, crowds already thick along Pennsylvania Avenue, the children in a car rather close behind. I had reminded them to use every moment to look at the people on both sides, to wave at them, to recognize anybody they knew with a special look that would let them know they were seen, because this would be our only moment of contact with many of them who had come from all the 50 states. And then we were on the inaugural stand, Muriel next to me, and then Linda and Lucy, and Lucia and Burge and Becky, and Tony and Martiana. And on the front row on the other side, Senator Jordan, the Speaker and Mrs. McCormick, the four Humphrey children, and Aunt Jessie and Aunt Josepha, the rest of the kinfolks and officials made up the little less than 100 on the inaugural stand. There they stretched in front of us, the people we were working for, thousands and thousands of them, so many of whom we had met face to face in their hometowns of Dime Box, Texas, or Dolan, South Dakota. I looked a familiar face. It was a long way back before I began to find them. B.W. with earmuffs on, Wesley, Melvin Winters, I decided the press had acquired all of the front row seats for their families, as well as their very numerous contingent that were covering it. The invocation was by Archbishop Robert Lucy of San Antonio, longtime crusading liberal of the vintage of Maury Maverick. He and Lyndon had known each other as long as Lyndon and I had, and there'd certainly been admiration on Lyndon's part. The Archbishop has always worked with zeal among the Latin Americans of San Antonio. And then Miss Leontine Price sang America the Beautiful. It was a rich voice and a rich song, one of the best moments. And then Rabbi Hyman Judah Schachter gave a prayer. Next, Hubert stepped forward. For once, his exuberance under wraps. He looked positively stern. I thought there was almost a tremor in his raised hand. Speaker McCormick administered the oath, and then Muriel kissed him. Reverend George Davis delivered a prayer. Then came the moment toward which all the days of the last year had been heading, the moment when Lyndon would take the oath of office as the 36th President of the United States, this time from the Chief Justice. It had first been mentioned to me by Leonard Marks that I should hold the Bible for his swearing in. We used the Bible his mother had given him when we moved to the ranch, Christmas of 1952. I do not know whether the idea originated in Lyndon's mind, or perhaps in Lizzie's, or in Leonard's own, but it was a sweet thing for any of them to do. I stood facing the throng between the Chief Justice and Lyndon while he took the oath. Lyndon's inaugural address of 1,100 words took, so the paper said, 22 minutes to deliver. And how many hours it had taken to write. Even while we were getting dressed, come to the ceremony itself, he had been rearranging a part about justice and liberty and union, Jack Valenti bounding in and out of the room like a rubber ball, taping over certain phrases on the teleprompter. I don't think I would have interrupted them if the building had been on fire. The line I liked best was the one about always trying. It is the excitement of becoming, always becoming, trying, probing, falling, resting and trying again, but always trying and always gaining. And I like the symbolism of about even now a rocket moves toward Mars, reminding all that the world will not be the same for our children or even for ourselves in a short span of years. And also, I like the beginning where he put the emphasis on the responsibility lying just exactly where it does, on each of us. Then the Mormon Tabernacle Choir sang. Lyndon himself had invited them, to the dismay of the inaugural officials, I expect, because there are 375 bodies, and there's hardly room for an extra flea in the plaza where the inauguration takes place. They'd had quite an adventure coming. The fog closed in at the airport at Salt Lake City on Tuesday before two of their jet planes could take off. So they went by bus 400 miles to Las Vegas and got on two other jets and had arrived at 7 o'clock this morning. They had certainly provided a happy waiting time for the thousands who congregated in the plaza because they had given them a concert for more than 30 minutes while they were gathering. Excellent idea, both for the choir that had come all that long distance to contribute its exceptional talent for the assembling restless multitudes. My old friend, His Bearded Eminence, Archbishop Iavacus, rose to give the benediction. And then there was a Star-Spangled Banner by the United States Marine Band, and it was all over. Lyndon and Vice President Humphrey were escorted up the steps between the assembled House and Senate and people they had worked with all their lives. And Muriel and I and all the others on the stand, almost 100 of us, went inside to the inauguration luncheon, at which Senator B. Everett Jordan presided. It was in the old Supreme Court chamber, and I was so glad the order of the majority leader not to have any more luncheons in this historic old chamber had been overridden by Senator Jordan in his capacity of, I think it is, head of the Rules Committee. And it was there that I found out about Cousin Fern Baines. Leonard came up to me and said, "What do you know? She turns out to be Hubert Humphrey's married sister. How is that for a political mutation?" He also said that the crowd was the largest in the history of the Capitol. 1,200,000, according to the chief of police, were in the square and lining the parade route. There were attractive silver ashtrays with the date engraved as a favor, and a delicious luncheon in which I could see Bessie's hand, because it was Texas Heart of filet mignon and ended with the president's delight for dessert. Then back in the bulletproof limousine, like a bubble of glass, we rode down Pennsylvania Avenue, waving at the filled bleachers, the lined sidewalks, in which the first row was usually little children in snowsuits, and the jammed office windows. How amazing that I should come almost face to face with Maureen Cranston Feger, and this the third time during these 3 days, at the Distinguished Ladies' Reception, at the Governor's Reception, and here. Well, that easily explains how she could become salutatorian of the class in Marshall High School some 36 years ago, if in a crowd like this she can make her way to the front row 3 times. I'd been glad to get a moment with Leontine Price in Everett Dirksen's office between the ceremony and the luncheon. Her voice is so rich, she's one of the great. I introduced her to as many of the relatives and Senate wives as were within reach. I heard that a lone spectator watching the parade from a balcony on an upper floor of the Justice Department turned out to be FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. He's seen a lot of us come and go. We arrived at the White House reviewing stand about 2:30 and found, what an innovation, there was a bulletproof glass barrier in front of us and small stoves right down by our feet. All this time, Lyndon, hatless and without an overcoat, had been quite warm enough with his thermal underwear on, but now he promptly turned off the stove because instead of the Spartan 2.5 hours we'd expected in the piercing cold, it was going to be quite cozy. As we'd come down the avenue, we had seen the Southwest Texas strutters who accompanied the band, stopped the procession, gotten out and crossed the street to shake hands with 3 or 4 of them. When we first walked into the stands, we encountered him and Blanco on leashes, waiting expectantly at the foot of them. And Lyndon promptly took him's leash from the attendant's hand, I believe it was Mr. Bryant, and escorted him into the reviewing stand, where that happy dog promptly took up his place in Lyndon's big leather upholstered viewing chair. He didn't get to occupy it long. He was soon returned to Mr. Bryant, but the crowd liked it. There had been quite a discussion as to which band would lead the parade, Little San Marcos, Southwest Texas State College Band, Lyndon's alma mater, or the proud orange and white of the University of Texas, and I, ardent university alumna, was belligerently in favor of San Marcos leading. And, as it turned out, San Marcos was the first of the state or school bands to pass by the president. We had the president of their school, Dr. McCrocklin, and his wife in the box with us to cheer and wave when they went by. And later, when the university went by, Chancellor Ransom and his pretty little wife. And then there were 2.5 hours of 52 bands and 15,000 marchers. Shorter, however, than any inaugural parade within memory, which makes Howard Burris, the parade committee chairman, a diplomat as well as an executive. Texas had a float that was a replica of the LBJ Ranch House, with a plastic Pernalis River, a toy dog that waved his tail, representing him. The float I really liked the best was Georgia's, which was a miniature Ladybird special, gaily painted, red, white, blue, green, a sort of a tuneful trolley vintage, and out of its windows waved attractive young girls in LBJ campaign uniforms, many of them the daughters of the hostesses from the Ladybird special, including Christy Carpenter playing Lucy and Patsy Derby playing me. There was more jumping up and down than at any Episcopal church service, to paraphrase Lyndon, because the flag went by every few moments. Sometimes I had to nudge Lyndon to let him know that it was coming, and to retrieve his attention as a governor approached in his open convertible, particularly at a sensitive moment when Wallace of Alabama or the governor of Mississippi were about to go by, because we wanted to accord them the dignity and welcome they were according us by their presence. Some of the far western states had delightful marching units or floats of bearded, buckskin-clad men with boots and big hats and long rifles, frontiersmen, trappers, hunters. One of the funniest was a man being dragged on a frontier-type stretcher behind a horse with a quivering arrow protruding from his chest, laid out cold. As he passed the reviewing stand, he sat straight up and saluted. The audience howled. It was a brandy keg-toting St. Bernard, mascot of the Chicago Fire Department, who was marching along in a Texas hat. I heard later that Beagle set up quite a yapping when he saw him, but to no avail. One of the prettiest of the units were the Barberettes of Santa Barbara, California, strutting past in snow-white Indian headdress, feathers that trailed from their head to their ankles, which had jingling bells around them. During the parade, various people joined us briefly. The McNamaras, while the military units were going by, and also General Wheeler. Lyndon signaled Sergeant Shriver and his three children, who were watching it from the other side. One of the children perched on top of his daddy's shoulder. They came over and sat with us a little. And Margaret Truman and Clifton Daniel came down when the Missouri float went by. Miss Kate Loney, Lyndon's first teacher, who now lives at Rough and Ready, California, was brought in for a few moments. In fact, there was quite a parade of governors, labor leaders, VIPs, little and big, nationally known variety, and Lyndon Johnson variety. Dale and Scooter were in the front row, and they must have been about ready to breathe a vast sigh of relief, because they've handled this whole big spectacle with great success. White House waiters filtered through the stand, passing snacks and bouillon and coffee. Lyndon kept on jumping up to greet friends back in the stands, tall Postmaster General James Farley, who always stands out everywhere, and Evangelist Billy Graham, who had conducted the prayer service at the National City Christian Church this morning. He was the main speaker at the prayer service, and a wonderful one, using a line that Sam Houston had used when he was finally converted and baptized, which combined humility with humor. Somebody told him that he heard all of his sins had been washed away, and he said, well, if they were, God help the fishes down in the stream. Billy Graham had been wonderful. Between Lennon's departures and returns, and the governors going by in their convertibles, saluting to us and we them, and the passing of the flags, it was an active 2.5 hours. And the most remarkable thing of all about the parade is that it was over on time, by 5 o'clock. Cheers to Howard Burris. Everybody began filing out of the stands to their numerous parties. We waved to the crowd across the street, walked back into the White House, gathering up as we went. George and Alice Brown, Wesley West, Homer Thornberry, and Eloise, we went upstairs to the second floor and settled comfortably for a drink. And how welcome it was. I soon had to leave them to put myself in the hands of Jean-Louis and Eddie Sins, with whom I took turns, along with a whole covey of little girls. But later I could hear the voices of A.W. and Melvin, and a few others, so there was no moment of rest for Lyndon between the parade and time to get dressed for the balls. At 9:15 we left the White House, with Linda and Lucy and following us, and went first to the Mayflower, the most civilized ball of all, because the smallest. We greeted those in the president's box, and then went out into an area roped off with velvet ropes and danced, changing partners every few seconds. At one point, Lyndon surprised Margaret Truman Daniel by lifting her bodily out of her box to the dance floor and twirling her around the room. They had a delightful picture together. We stayed only about 30 minutes, the first of 5 stops, a regular marathon. Next was the Statler Hilton, and then the Armory, where there were 13,000 people. Tonight, the decorations had all been changed. Still the blue streamers, but enormous bouquets of bright flowers hanging from the ceiling. The theme was America the Beautiful, and there were landscapes along the wall of scenic America, from sea to shining sea, mountains, fruited plains, and all. It was a great job, but there's absolutely no way to make regal and dignified and elegant a ball in which 13,000 humans participate. So that when we left the box, started down to the dance floor, it was like plunging into the University of Texas, Oklahoma football crowd. I really felt dreadful to see how the Secret Service had to push against the crowd to make the few feet in which we danced possible. After just a few changes, we went back up to the box. Lyndon tried to use the microphone to thank everyone. It didn't work, the first goof of the 3 days that I'm aware of. So he talked without it, and then presently it came on with a blare. Next to Shoreham, which was full of Minnesotans, where Hubert planned to return. At each one, we stayed about 30 minutes. And then at last to the Sheraton Park, where all the Texans congregated. And there, Lyndon made a delightful little speech. Never before have so many paid so much to dance so little. And one thing you can say for the great society, it sure is crowded. He'd been in fine spirits all evening, had changed partners as rapidly as possible, dancing with Muriel, Linda, any cabinet wives that were handy, and the wives of those who had particularly helped with the inaugural. I glanced over my shoulder, hoping that he would find Scooter and Dorothy Marks. and think for a fleeting moment I saw them both with him. I was really quite pleased with my upswept hairdo, which I hadn't worn in 20 or so years, and in the yellow satin ensemble. Only one trouble, it's much handsomer with the coat on, more regal, and add about 13,000 human bodies and you have a Turkish bath. At the Sheraton Park, we saw innumerable Texans, including the Max Brooks, and for a moment, Leela Wynn. Leonard was our guardian angel throughout, and timekeeper. Adley got just about the biggest tan of anyone at the Sheraton Park. The presidential box was filled with notables to give everybody something to look at and tell about when they got home, in case they couldn't dance. Like Cinderella, we tried to make it home by midnight, and actually left the Sheraton Park just a little past 12, and were back in the house by 12:30. Grateful that everything had been accomplished with dignity and grace, and that it was over.